Hello and welcome to episode 30 of Not Reserving Judgment, a podcast about the latest intrigues, triumphs, and outrages in Canadian constitutional law. I'm Josh DeHaas, counsel with the Canadian Constitution Foundation.
And I'm Christine Van Guyen, the CCF's litigation director. Joanna is away today.
In today's episode, we'll discuss how a group of activist lawyers in Edmonton has been ordered to pay city taxpayers back after dragging them to court over homeless encampments.
And we'll share our bad legal takes of the week, where we take a lighthearted look at some legal opinions that didn't quite land.
But first, I'm going to tell you about the latest misguided bylaw that is probably coming from a good place, but that is also probably unconstitutional. Christine, do you remember Stephen Del Duca, the former Liberal leader of Ontario, whose platform in the 2022 election was to, cancel building the new highway through the GTA suburbs that he needed to win and force all the kids to be vaccinated for COVID months after their pandemic ended? Remember that guy?
I definitely remember him.
Yes. Well, after winning 8 of 124 of the province's seats, he left that job and became mayor of a Toronto suburb called Vaughan. And now he's back with another one of his brilliant policy ideas. For those who don't know, Vaughan is home to the Toronto area's biggest, or one of the Toronto area's biggest Jewish communities, Thornhill. And Thornhill has been experiencing some very nasty protests that are ostensibly about Zionism or, quote, settlements in the West Bank, but in fact are quite obviously aimed at taunting Jews who are going to pray. As our executive director, Joanna Barron, has pointed out in a recent column in The Hub, that's been very widely read, by the way, the CCF strongly supports the right to protest, but some things do cross the line, including where there's incitement to violence or when you commit crimes like intimidation, which includes blocking the streets and the sidewalks. And politicians really should be speaking out forcefully when protests target synagogues or other places like Jewish schools or daycares. You know, protesting these places may be legal, but it's not a very nice thing to do.
Yeah, this is what Joanna calls lawful but awful.
Exactly. So Mr. Del Duca, instead of just condemning these protests and calling for the current laws that we already have to be enforced, has proposed yet another municipal bylaw that won't actually do anything to help, but will probably offend the Constitution. And what Mr. Del Duca has proposed here is a bylaw that would prohibit demonstrations of, quote, a nature that are intended to intimidate, incite hatred, incite violence, or incite discrimination, whatever that means, within 100 meters of a religious institution, school, child care center, hospital, congregate care center, or other, quote, vulnerable social infrastructure. And it would come with fines of up to $100,000, or possibly just $100,000. It's hard to say because it's awkwardly worded. And this bylaw is not as bad as the new speech controlling bylaws we've seen out of Calgary or Waterloo, which target speech that is more obviously protected. For example, in Calgary, you can't protest within 100 meters of a library if your protest is in relation to a long list of controversial subjects like sex or gender, and specifically
a bylaw we're challenging, by the way, which is right. it's also unconstitutional.
Yeah, it is. It's bad. And we're challenging it. I think our judicial review is going to be heard in 2025, because for some reason, this is not a priority for the courts. But, you know, this was aimed at Drag Queen Story Hour. And as much as I think some of those protests got out of hand, you should be able to peacefully protest something like that in a free and democratic society. Waterloo, also, you can now be ticketed for what they call harassment by merely saying something that's offensive. And this is obviously not something that I think our Constitution allows. So Vaughan's bylaw is not as bad as those, but there are some pretty big red flags. So one concern is that it's overbroad. And as far as I know, the really disturbing protests have been in front of a single particular synagogue. And yet this proposed bylaw applies to a very large amount of space, you know, 100 meters of within 100 meters of schools, daycares, religious institutions, so vulnerable social infrastructure. I'm not sure what that means, Christine. I don't know, like, does Canada's Wonderland count as social infrastructure or Vaughn Mills the most essential social infrastructure?
We don't know because we don't have a text of this bylaw. We just have Del Duca's tweets at this point.
I suspect the bylaw when we have it won't even clarify that, but you're right. We don't have the text, so it could be less bad than it seems.
It's probably going to be more bad.
Usually is. As our listeners know, limits on charter rights need to be for pressing and substantial purposes, and the laws need to be minimally impairing of the rights to expression and assembly. And maybe you can make that case for the synagogue where these protests have taken place, but I'm not sure about, half the city. And that's really is what this sounds like it'll apply to. Even City Hall in Vaughan, which is the place that's the most constitutionally protected for protests, would be encompassed under this because there's a daycare inside City Hall. Also, I just want to point out, if the problem is with one particular synagogue, why not get an injunction against protesters if past protests have been calling for violence or have resulted in violence, which is what was recently successfully done in Montreal. On top of that, police can already use criminal laws against things like intimidation, public incitement to hatred, willful promotion of anti-Semitism, which are all aimed at the same problem as this bylaw. There's even a section of the criminal code that says everyone who willfully disturbs or interrupts an assemblage of persons met for religious worship for a moral, social, or benevolent purpose is guilty of an offense. So police could use that section of the criminal code. And the criminal law is preferable to a bylaw because it has safeguards in place. Like when we're talking about hate speech, there's a requirement for AG approval. There's also the proof beyond reasonable doubt standard and case law that narrows the risk of being charged in the first place. Plus, those are enforced by specialized police teams rather than bylaw officers. And, what exactly is an intention to discriminate anyway? If someone wants to hold a rally where they say something like, there's no such thing as transgender children, is that going to lead to a $100,000 fine? Whether you endorse that viewpoint or not, our rights are supposed to protect controversial speech. And I think that's a view that many Canadians hold and they should be allowed to express in society. The other big problem, Christine, you and I were talking about this the other day, is just that they don't really have any business making criminal laws. Criminal laws are the exclusive domain of the federal government. And while it's true under 9215 of the Constitution Act, provinces can enact penal sanctions and fine people for matters that are under their own provincial jurisdiction, we also know from the 1983 Supreme Court case Westendorp that cities, which are creatures of the province, can't enact what are in pith and substance criminal laws simply by claiming that they're regulating the use of public property. In that case, Westendorp, Calgary had passed a bylaw that said, quote, no person shall approach another person on the street for the purposes of prostitution. And Calgary claimed that this was not aimed at prostitution, but just at preventing prostitutes from collecting on city streets or interfering with the rights and ability of members of the public to move freely and peacefully on city streets. The Supreme Court said, no, this purpose is obviously a criminal law purpose to control prostitution. And so the bylaw was ultra vires. And the purpose of Vaughan's proposed bylaw is also just obviously a criminal law purpose. It's regulating hate speech and intimidation, something we already have laws on and something that they have no business writing laws on. So, I appreciate the sentiment of Del Duca. It's good to speak out against these really awful protests that have been intimidating Jewish people. But, I don't think this bylaw is really the right way to go. Christine, do you have anything to add? We talked about this a lot yesterday.
Yeah, I think my favorite part of it was Del Duca in his tweet said that this is aimed at unpeaceful protests. And it just shows how absolutely redundant that is. First of all, unpeaceful protests are not protected by the Charter. Section 2C of the Charter is very explicit that it guarantees the right to peaceful assembly. So unpeaceful activities are not even given charter protection. And since they're not given charter protections, there's all kinds of existing police powers and tools and laws that deal with disturbing the peace or incitement to violence or actual violence or interrupting religious services or incitement to hatred. The part about this that is weird to me that I have some concerns about is the language in the tweet that Del Duca used, where it's suggested that they were going to prohibit assemblies that are incitement to discrimination. And you mentioned that, Josh. I don't know what that means. I don't think they know what that means. And I don't know if that's actually what's going to be included in the text of the bylaw, or if it was just some odd phrasing, because the way that sentence was structured made it a bit unclear if they were going to, what they were actually proposing. So I think, I don't want to jump the gun and condemn every part of this proposal, since we don't actually have a proposal yet. We just have one statement by Del Duca saying that this is what they're going to plan something like this. But to me, I think it's redundant to ban things that are already banned. I gave you the example of, you know, if the city wanted to pass a bylaw prohibiting murder, it's like, well, okay. I mean, murder is already illegal. These things that you're proposing to prohibit are already also illegal. And you're maybe treading into federal jurisdiction by proposing a maybe criminal law in what they're doing here. So it's kind of maybe a more of a political statement that he wants to do this. And I think the better question to ask is why is the mayor not working with police to ensure that police are actually given the resources that they need to enforce the existing criminal law? That's the bigger issue to me.
Tell me about what's going on in Edmonton and what this activist group is now facing.
Yeah, so this, I read about this, and it was a CBC article that a listener of the podcast sent in to me and asked my opinion, because it's about public interest litigation, and we obviously do a lot of public interest litigation. This is, I ended up reading the actual cases underlying this news story. So I'll give you the high level. In Edmonton, there have been a lot of problems with these homeless encampments. Sorry, don't cancel me. Encampments of people experiencing homelessness. Now, if I do use
no, the... Christine, we've already moved.
Unhoused. Sorry,
it's unhoused now.
Yeah, now people experiencing having an unhoused experience. I don't know. So sorry if I use the term homeless and you're deeply traumatized by that. I am who I am, and I'm probably going to say it. So the city has been having issues with these encampments. They've been dismantling them, saying that they present public safety risks, both to the people in the encampments and to the community at large. So some of the examples of risks are, there have been fires. The Alberta Minister of Public Safety also called the encampments, to quote him, gang-run drug camps that enable drug dealing, human trafficking, rape, crime, and violence. They're not safe places to sleep or live. We know that organized crime and gang members are infiltrating the encampments. They're violently enforcing tent taxes, forcing vulnerable people to pay for access to water and the ability to pitch a tent or access bridges and walkways. So the city, obviously, and the province think that these encampments are a problem. So they began clearing them, taking down the tents, as well as the piles of various items that had been all over these camps. So some people objected to the clearing of the encampments. There's an organization called the Coalition for Justice and Human Rights, and they filed a statement of claim seeking declarations to stop the encampments from being cleared out. They brought the claim and asked for standing as a public interest litigant, and they claimed various charter breaches, Section 2C assembly, 2D association, Section 7 life, liberty, and security of person, Section 8 privacy rights, Section 12 cruel and unusual punishment, and of course, Section 15 equality rights. But the government fought back against this lawsuit. There was an interim injunction that temporarily paused the clearing of the encampments, but ultimately, the government argued that this coalition did not have public interest standing. They could not even bring the claim. So this is interesting to me because we at the CCF, obviously, we often bring cases as public interest litigants. For example, our successful legal challenge to the invocation of the Emergencies Act, that was as a public interest litigant. And our successful legal challenge to the Canadian Elections Act was also as a public interest litigant. And the court actually in the Emergencies Act case affirmed the importance of the role of public interest litigants in bringing cases and specifically named us as a reason for the successful outcome in that case. So we were also an intervener in a Supreme Court case about the test for public interest standing when an organization can bring a claim as an organization instead of requiring the individual affected person who's impacted by a law to bring that claim. So that case was called Council of Canadians with Disabilities, and it sort of reaffirmed the circumstances for when public interest standing can be granted. And essentially, there's three things the court that asks when deciding if a group like us or like this coalition in Edmonton, if they can bring public interest standing. And the question is there a serious justiciable issue? The second is whether the party bringing the action has a genuine interest in the matter. And the third is whether the proposed suit is a reasonable and effective means of bringing the case. So applying the test in this case to the encampment issue, the court found that there is a serious justiciable issue, but that the coalition is a pretty new organization that doesn't have a long or consistent history advocating for the rights of homeless people, and they don't have a reputation as an advocate for the homeless. The court was pretty critical of the argument that this coalition could even bring public interest standing. They said that the coalition board members come together and learn from each other, but they haven't even produced any publications for the public for the last 2 years, and that they don't believe that their role is public outreach. The court said that the coalition couldn't identify any formal research projects and confirmed it has no records of research pertaining to the homeless, that the coalition has never filed any human rights complaints in Edmonton. And in terms of litigation experience, the court said that this was the first housing-related litigation launched by the Edmonton Coalition, and that their housing-specific advocacy is really just limited to two letters that were written in 2020, one of which I think wasn't even replied to. Notwithstanding that the coalition's objectives, the court said, is to demand accountability from all levels of government, upon review of the evidence, the court said that they don't, in fact, bear any of the hallmarks of a party with a real stake or genuine interest in the outcome. And in assessing whether or not to grant public interest standing as part of the cumulative analysis, all of this weighed against granting standing. So on the third prong, so all of that related to the second prong. The first prong, yes, this is a justiciable issue, but on the second prong about if they have a genuine interest, the court said that they did not really think that they did. On the third prong, the question is whether there is this is a reasonable way to bring the case. And again, the court found against the coalition. They said that given the coalition's lack of experience and lack of expertise in advocating for and working with the homeless, there are serious concerns that this case that the coalition was trying to bring would actually prejudice and hurt subsequent challenges for the homeless brought by people with specific and factually established complaints. Although the court found that the subject matter was a public interest subject matter, there are alternative means to bring the claim. And in fact, the court found that many organizations that do a lot more to serve the homeless had actually chosen not to bring a claim. And so that weighs again against this particular coalition. So in whole, the court refused to grant the coalition public interest standing, and that essentially killed the whole case. And the lawsuit was scrapped. And since that happened, 604 encampment sites in Edmonton have been taken down. Now, the interesting twist is the court, since they denied public interest standing and the case has been scrapped, the city sought to recoup their costs. So the city, their total legal bill for the city was about $42,000. They asked for this Edmonton coalition to pay $25,000 in cost. Now there's a general presumption that costs are awarded to the successful party, which in this case was obviously the city, but there's a different test for costs when there is a public interest litigant. Courts in different provinces have developed different tests for how costs are awarded. And in Ontario, that test is from a case called Friends of the Toronto Public Cemeteries. In Alberta, the four factors for awarding costs or not against a public interest litigant, the court will ask, was the case a public interest case? Was the action involving a novel point of law? Was it a test case? And are there access to justice concerns? And using that framework in this particular case, the court found that costs should still be awarded. They said the subject matter is a public interest issue, but because the coalition lacked standing, the court still had to spend resources on a case where there was no possibility of a decision on the merits. So even if the topic was a public interest topic, there was not a possibility that a public interest issue could be resolved. The court also found that this wasn't a novel point of law. There have been many cases about this topic, but they did say it could be called a test case. So in balancing these different factors, the court decided to award the city $11,500 in costs, which this Edmonton coalition have to be paid. So the question for us as a public interest advocacy organization, or what are the implications for us? As I said, we had someone send us this case asking if it could impact our work. I don't really think so. This is an application of the existing law, and we as an organization are not faced with the same types of problems that this Edmonton coalition are faced with. We are not a new organization like this coalition. We are a longstanding organization. We've existed for over 20 years, and we've done a lot of complex litigation, and we've done it successfully. We've appeared at every level of court, including the Supreme Court. And I think what this case does show, though, is the importance of really having your organization set up properly and ensuring that you are well-funded and well-governed, and that and it also shows the importance of the types of cases that you take. You should be taking cases strategically and choosing ones where you have a possibility of succeeding. And we're really careful with how we choose our cases and how we govern them ourselves. So while the possibility of adverse costs is always a risk that every public interest litigant can face, I don't think that there's anything new coming out of this case. There's nothing new that shows the risks that we are faced with as public interest litigants. And overall, I think the idea of awarding costs against a public interest organization like this particular coalition is to discourage frivolous complaints by organizations that aren't set up well and that don't have a possibility of succeeding. So I know this might be like a technical case about how things at organizations like ours work, but it's really important for our actual day-to-day functioning. So Josh, any thoughts on this particular case, any aspect of it? And don't worry, if you accidentally say homeless, I won't cancel you.
Yeah, I just think this line of cases where people are claiming there's a constitutional right to encampments I'm not really that into it. Like there were a number of cases in BC where judges said, oh, you can't ban camping in the park overnight because homeless people have nowhere else to go, and that's a violation of their security of the person if they are, you know, physically harmed because they can't pitch a tent. And that sounds actually more like a positive right than something protected under Section 7. But in the last couple of years, after the encampments exploded during COVID-19, because, you know, cities started turning a blind eye to them, saying like, well, we can't force people into shelters if they're going to be at risk of COVID. Courts in Alberta and Ontario have now taken this up and basically said there's a constitutional right to like camp overnight in any park. And this has led to like really obviously super dangerous, horrible encampments that should not be allowed to continue. And yet municipalities are being told, oh, there's a right, people have a right to camp overnight. I saw this week, Kingston, Ontario, they were one of the places that was told by a judge, you can't clean up this encampment, even though you have, you know, shelter spaces for everyone. And the city has said, okay, well, if people have a constitutional right to camp overnight, we're going to still enforce this during the day. So people will have, they can't build, you know, little mini houses in the park. They'll have to just like pitch their tent every night. And people are saying this is cruel, but it's like, you know, the rest of us also deserve to have a safe park to go to. So I'm kind of on team Kingston on this. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll quickly do our bad legal takes.
Hi, I'm Russell from the CCF. In case you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to our email newsletter, The Freedom Update, to get updates from me every week about our ongoing work and the legal stories in Canada that keep us interested. It's one of the best ways to stay up to date. Subscribe at theccf.ca/freedomupdate.
Mine goes to an American lawyer called Kate Kelly, who describes herself as a constitutional equality enthusiast, lesbian with exceptional taste, and abortion pills fanatic. And her tweet says this, ages of the founding fathers on July 4th, 1776, James Monroe, 18, Aaron Burr, 20, Alexander Hamilton, 21, James Madison, 25, Thomas Jefferson, 33, John Adams, 40, George Washington, 44. Like, what? She writes, this explains so much. The Constitution was basically a Reddit post. And for those who don't know what she's talking about, Reddit is an online site where people post articles and write comments on every topic, but it's often derided by people on the left as a hangout for overzealous young men who, you know, don't really know what they're talking about and get into all these heated arguments about politics. And there's a lot of, you know, mansplaining going on. And it's true that Reddit does skew pretty young and male, just like Twitter, because for whatever reason, young men are more anxious to, you know, debate stuff. But what makes this a bad legal take is that there is simply no denying the success or the legal heft of the Declaration of Independence, regardless of how old people were when it was written. Whatever your theory about, you know, what law really is or what it's doing, I suspect she's one of the more cynical people about law. Generation after generation of not only Americans, but Democrats from around the world, including in Canada, have been inspired by the words written by those zealous young men. Words like, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And of course, as some have pointed out, the first draft of the Declaration of Independence was written by Thomas Jefferson, who was 33 at the time. And I guess that's young considering that you have to be 35 to be president, or apparently 75 in 2024. But 33 is still old enough to know something about life. And it's young people who tend to make some of the more, you know, radical and truly lasting changes throughout history. I'd also point out that if we're talking about the U.S. Constitution itself, the first draft was actually written by James Wilson, and he was in his mid-40s at the time. If anything, rather than detracting from the authority of the Declaration of Independence or the U.S. Constitution, I think the fact that the Founding Fathers were mostly in their 20s or early 30s simply shows how suppressed the ambitions of the current generation of young males is. Like, young men who are sort of 18 to 25 are now forced to sit silently in universities, where if they push back even in the slightest way against the postmodern orthodoxy of the so-called progressives who dominate these institutions, they face academic sanctions and threats that they'll be canceled or forced out of the job market before they've even started their careers. And just yesterday, there was more evidence of this in Toronto Life, of all places, where I read that the University of Toronto has appointed a professor named Randy Boyagoda to be their advisor on civil discourse. And this is because the university has become such a frightening place for young men. And I do mean young men to express opinions. Professor Boyagoda, who is, by the way, not white, says he was almost canceled for pushing back against the orthodox view on cultural appropriation. Apparently, he tried to discuss this with a young woman of color at university, and as soon as he did, another student whipped out their phone and started recording, presumably because they wanted to cancel him for not, you know, having the correct point of view. And he says young men, like, they'll tell him they won't speak up or say anything about certain topics because they're afraid of being labeled anti-woman, and people on campus are not able to, you know, talk in any nuanced way about their most famous alumnus, Professor Jordan Peterson. And that's a really sad state of affairs because we should be able to, you know, discuss things at universities. So my bad legal take goes to Kate Kelly for suggesting that the Declaration of Independence is worthy of mockery just because the people who wrote it were young, idealistic men. Christine, what's your bad legal take?
First, I just want to say how depressed I am that I have not written a constitution or a declaration of independence or anything at this level.
We're just late bloomers.
At my age, yeah, maybe. I mean, 18, holy. My reaction is the exact opposite of this Kelly person. I mean, I read that and I'm incredibly impressed. So my bad legal take is all about the various bad legal takes in a recent Supreme Court decision in a case called R.V. Kirk. And this case involved a sexual assault, a rape specifically. And the part that of the case that a lot of people have taken issue with or commented on is the Supreme Court made some comments about the language of the trial court. And specifically, the Supreme Court said that the trial court's use of the term woman may have been unfortunate and engendered confusion. And the court then used the term person with a vagina. So there have been bad legal takes basically on every side of this issue. And, you know, some people have said, this is crazy. The court is telling us we shouldn't use the term woman and instead should use the term person with a vagina. That is not what happened. That is not what the court said in this case. Although I understand why people reached that conclusion. Other people have said in the context of this case, using the term person with a vagina is a lot clearer and more inclusive. This is also wrong for a lot of reasons. I think it makes things less clear. And I also, just for my own personal reasons, I hate the term person with a vagina. I think that it is degrading. We shouldn't refer to anyone, let alone rape victims, by reference to their genitals. We are so much more than that. So what's important to know to understand why these takes are all wrong is the context of the case. So what happened was there was a question about whether or not the complainant, the woman in this case, whether or not she had been raped. She said she was raped by the accused. The accused said, no, I did not rape her. Specifically, the allegation was that he had vaginally penetrated her with his penis. And the accused said that although she was very intoxicated that evening and she has a bad memory of some of the details of that night, she very clearly could identify the sensation of a penis in her vagina. And the trial court said, yes, we can agree with the common sense understanding that a woman would know the feeling of a penis in her vagina. And that is what the defense counsel objected to. They objected to the idea that you could generalize about all women, that all women would recognize this sensation. It isn't possible for the trial court to generalize that way, that you would have needed experts about nerves and things like that to make a comment like that. And the Supreme Court says that it was that language that was unfortunate because the trial judge, the Supreme Court said, wasn't necessarily generalizing about all women, but specifically talking about how this woman would not be confused about the feeling. And it seems like the Supreme Court was saying it was unfortunate to use the term a woman because in this context, it created a lack of clarity between a generalization, which trial courts are not supposed to do, with a specific experience of this particular complainant. And so they found that, you know, this complainant that the trial court said a person with a vagina would be unlikely to be mistaken about that feeling. So I do agree with the outcome in this case. I do think that we can draw common sense conclusions that this complainant could identify the sensation of rape. I don't even object to the common sense conclusion that women generally can identify this sensation. And I don't think that there's anything unfortunate about saying so. But the court still chose to go further. And for some reason, they think it's more clear to say a person with a vagina would not be mistaken about this feeling. And to be clear, no one in this case identifies as transgender. There's no trans issues in this case. So the sentence where the Supreme Court says this about this generalization, about people with vaginas and versus the term women, I mean, the whole part of the case is a contradiction in itself within one paragraph, because the court is generalizing about a person with a vagina. They say that is okay, but to generalize about a woman would engender confusion. So this whole paragraph is really confusing. The distinction between generalizing about women makes no sense when the court then generalizes about people with vaginas. And I just think it's completely unnecessary to use the term person with a vagina. I think if anything, that engenders more confusion, because then you get into a whole debate about transgender people and if a trans woman with a surgical vagina, if like this generalization from the Supreme Court would apply to trans women as well. And I actually don't think you could make that generalization. I have to assume that those sensations would be very different. But look, there were a lot of bad legal takes on every side. I think it's really important to understand the context of what the Supreme Court was saying here. I still object to the term person with a vagina. I think the court shouldn't have used it, but they were not saying that we can't use the term woman. But I still think we should watch out for this term person with a vagina being used in future cases. And I really hope that it's not. Okay, that's it for my bad legal take.
As usual, we hope you'll rate us, review us, and subscribe. And just a reminder, you can support our work by subscribing to the CCF's YouTube channel, by following us on Twitter, or by visiting our website, theccf.ca, where you can sign up for our Freedom Update newsletter from our colleague Russ. And the Canadian Constitution Foundation is a nonpartisan legal charity funded by donations, so please click that donate button on our website if you can. Thanks for listening.